the trials, errors, and even joys of taking care of our parents when they get old.
There was so much that I was scared about. I'm an only child, and I have no experience as a caretaker. I don't have kids. I don't have dogs. I didn't, at least before. I haven't led a particularly domestic life. Probably I've lived a careerist life, and I just didn't know whether I could do this.
That's George Hodgman. We talk with him about his wonderful memoir about taking care of his mother in her declining years. It's called Bettyville, first published in 2015 and now out in paperback. Then we re-air my 2011 interview with Dr. Alan Teal about his innovative approach to caring for seniors. His book is Alone and Invisible No More. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When George Hodgman left Manhattan for Paris to visit his aging mother, he didn't realize it would be the beginning of an unintended tenure as a caregiver. That was Paris, Missouri, not France, and his hometown was the last place he thought he would end up living after a successful career in the publishing industry in New York. For one thing, he'd never felt comfortable coming out as a gay man in his hometown. It wasn't even something he'd been able to discuss with his parents. He loved both his parents, but had special closeness with his mother growing up. She was a vivacious, beautiful woman, but as with all of us, age caught up with her. After her husband died, she was alone in the house. When Hodgman made that fateful visit, it was soon clear that she needed more help than he could provide long distance, and he stepped up to the plate like the good son he was. But it wasn't easy for two strong-willed people to negotiate their new roles with each other. Bettyville is a poignant, funny, and beautifully written memoir that examines, as one reviewer said, the warm yet fraught relationship between mother and son with profound insight and understanding. George Hodgman is a veteran magazine and book editor who's worked at Simon & Schuster, Vanity Fair, and Talk Magazine. His writing has appeared in Entertainment Weekly, Interview, and Harper's Bazaar, among other publications. George Hodgman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have written this just searingly honest memoir, very beautiful. Let's start out with how this came about to be. This memoir got birthed, basically, when you came to celebrate your mother's 91st birthday and ended up staying. Now, you were living in New York. You were working in the publishing industry. You were working at Vanity Fair, I believe, at the time?
No, Vanity Fair was a long time ago. I had worked in at Vanity Fair and book publishing companies as an editor, and I had lost my job and was freelancing and had, you know, spent more and more time here as the years had, you know, passed, and particularly since I had begun freelancing. And I came back, and my mother had lost her driver's license. And she was so independent, and she drove so much, and it was such a big part of her that was departing with that loss. So I started remembering, and I remembered that scene where my mother takes me to school and drives me really fast down the highway, and we're listening to the radio and singing along with the radio. And that was the way it sort of began. And then I really began taking things down. And the book, there was so much that I was scared about. I'm an only child, and I have no experience as a caretaker. I don't have kids. I don't have dogs. I didn't, at least before. I, you know, I, I haven't led a particularly domestic life. I've lived a careerist life, and I just didn't know whether I could do this and whether I could get through the sadness and also just do the stuff like taking care of insurance and all these things that seemed to be falling down that she had let go. And so I think that the book, I hope, is kind of for people who are scared, you know, and who don't know whether they can get through this. Mm. And there are a lot of other books by sort of hyper-organized, sensible women dealing with their beloved mothers. And this is a book about a complicated relationship and about someone who's trying his best to do the right thing and rise to the occasion.
And she was not exactly a help in that too often, because she didn't take kindly to her need for help. And talk about that.
Well, I wouldn't have wanted somebody who took kindly to somebody coming in and trying to take over and gain control. And, you know, I respected that she held on to her life and her autonomy and her, you know, desire to keep control. I liked that spirit. Mm-hmm. It wasn't always the easiest thing to deal with, but I saw what it was coming from, you know, and because we all want to have control of our lives, mm-hmm. and want to have control of, you know, the big things. And when we lose control of the big things, I think, at least with my mother, she began to exert a really large amount of control over little things, mm-hmm. like the shoes or the, you know, exactly what she wanted to eat or when she would do what she was willing to do. So I think part of it, you know, it is a battle over control. I didn't even want control, believe me. I didn't want it. I would have been happy for her to keep it. But, you know, you kind of have to parent your parent without letting them know that you are.
I found that because I went through a very similar situation with my mother. I found that the most difficult thing, it was really, you know, I think now 3 years after her death, I'm still beating myself up for the ways in which I engaged in that battle, in which I couldn't gracefully let her believe that she had more control than she did. For one thing, I believed that she was dumb enough to fall for it.
Well, there are all kinds of things that we don't know how to do or deal with. We're not trained. This is all new. We are dealing with their feelings, and we're dealing with our feelings because they don't want to give up, and we also don't really want them to. We want them to stay parents and take care of us. So it's so complicated, and there are lots of things, lots of days where that I look back on, and I wish I had done things differently. There was a day, it was so hard to get my mother going. If we had to go out of the house, you know, if we had to do something. And there was a day when, it was just a terrible day when I had to rush her so hard and just rush her into the car and almost, you know, I look back on that day and I think I was really just not very gentle. But on the other hand, I was here, and I know that my mother was never alone. She didn't have to feel like she was alone facing her losses. And so I think that's the main thing.
And how was it for you to face her losses?
It was sad. Because like I say, I mean, I still wanted to be Baby Bear, even though I was a grown-up man. You know, we all want our parents to, you know, maintain that role where they're taking care of us. And also there's just the incredible, you know, nostalgia of losing home and losing these people who you love a little bit at a time and watching them go through this hard struggle.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, now tell us a little bit about your relationship to your mother as a child. I mean, you have that wonderful scene that you've already referred to of how she drove you to school. But you guys were really buddies.
I think my mother and I were very much alike in many ways, that my mother could really see certain parts of herself in me. But I was an only child, and so I was kind of an adult with my parents. And so I think I had a lot of adult behavior, though I was also very childish. And I don't know how to exactly sum up our relationship except to say that we were close, though that didn't stop us from getting on each other's nerves and sometimes hurting each other.
Mm-hmm. You mean when you were a child with her?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My mother was a demanding woman. She wanted me to excel. She wanted me to get good grades, and she wanted me to do certain things. And she was a pusher. Mm-hmm. And I wanted sometimes to have someone who was maybe just a little bit more tender or something, but we also shared a sense of humor and a lot of different parts of our sensibility, and you know, we were always united.
Always united?
Yeah. I think we had we were always for the other. We might have our momentary reservations, but if anybody had done anything to my mother, or if, you know, we would have immediately helped each other in any way, in any circumstance.
Except in one very big way that, you know, is also very much part of this beautiful memoir, Bettyville, George Hodgman. And that is that, you know, from a pretty early age, you realized that you were different. You know, you grew up in Paris, Missouri. And then in high school, you began to put a name on it, that you were gay. And that was a big secret at the heart of your relationship with not only your mother, but your father as well.
It was the times, you know. It was, people forget. I mean, I graduated from high school in 1977, college in 81, and, you know, it wasn't until the late 70s that people were out and coming out. And believe me, they weren't in Paris, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And my parents didn't grow up around gay people. They, you know, it wasn't the city. They didn't know gay people. They didn't know anything about the life. And my parents would have done anything to be supportive of me, but this was a really hard bridge for them, and we also just didn't know, we hadn't learned any way to communicate about it very well. And, you know, it was pre-Oprah, and we were struggling to not hurt each other. I think that was what it was, is that they didn't want to hurt me, but they didn't really know what to do in terms of my sexuality, and I thought that if they knew, that they would be hurt, that they would be disappointed, and that was what I really didn't want to do, was hurt them or disappoint them.
And how do you think that affected you as a person? I mean, you say at one point in this book, you repeat a phrase that I think you read somewhere, that shame is inventive, in the context of writing about these things. And I wondered if you tell us more about that. What do you mean by shame is inventive?
Well, you know, I don't read Nietzsche. I'm not that intellectual or anything, but that Nietzsche said that. And I didn't quote him in the book because I thought it would sound pretentious, but shame is inventive, and shame and secrets are what a lot of problems grow out of. And I think that gay kids grow up thinking they're wrong a lot of times, or at least they used to, and that gives you a lot of baggage from the very beginning. If you're hiding, if you're concealing, if, you know, and in some deep place in yourself, you think that you are bad. And I think that it takes an active parent, an active community, active people around you to see that and help you through that. And it's just something that didn't happen in years past. And I think that there's a certain kind of self-consciousness that you can go along with shame. I think that there is an inability to really do very well in relationships because you don't think you're deserving or worthwhile. And I think that, you know, I had drug issues for a time in my life, and I think that that grew out of that too.
Yeah, in fact, you were really a young man kind of in your prime when the AIDS crisis was full-blown.
Yeah, the first year I was in New York City, as you learn in the book, I lived in New York City for 25 years, and then I came back here to this small town to take care of my mother. But by that time, I was a real New Yorker, and the AIDS crisis was very early on when I came to New York, and it was a scary time. And the reason that I write about it in the book, and since it's a book that really deals with my relationship with my mother, is because during those years, I was so scared that I was going to get sick and that it would destroy my parents. And that fear was another thing that I walked with and that I was dealing with. And I think that for a lot of us, gay men in New York City and other places, that drugs were a kind of handy way to escape the reality of our lives during the AIDS crisis.
You even wrote your parents a letter at that time that you didn't send.
Yeah. Well, I was 22 years old, and at the beginning, we didn't know very much about AIDS. You know, people got sick very fast and they died very fast, and we didn't know much about preventative measures or anything. And so I really, you know, and like a lot of us, I really thought I could, you know, just get sick any day and die. And I didn't want to go home and be sick and have them go through the suffering of taking care of me. And so I wrote my parents a letter that they would have if I died, telling them that I loved them and that I cared about them and, you know, trying to help them through this loss. And I kept it on the bureau in my bedroom, and I don't know where it is now.
I was just going to ask you, did you keep it? You didn't throw it away.
I didn't consciously throw it away, but I think there was a certain point where I didn't want to look at it anymore, mm-hmm. where I knew that I was healthy, and when we had some respite from the notion of the fear of the disease, and I think I probably was, I moved or changed apartments and put it somewhere. I think I know where I could look for it. But in a drawer where I keep my important papers. But
now, your father, you know, we've been talking about your parents. Your father just seemed like, you know, a really good guy. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with him.
My father was, I don't really know. We had a really good relationship, I think. It was, my father was very warm, and he was very gregarious, and he loved to party. He loved to have some drinks and sing, but he was also very hardworking, and And I think that my father sort of got that I was different, but that he thought that it would somehow reconcile, and that he didn't, I don't think he thought that I was actually going to grow up to be a gay man. And I think that my father had, his family was religious in a certain way, and he was more conservative inside than he appeared on the outside, and I think that my sexuality was a real obstacle for him.
And it came up, it sounds like it came up once with your mother, just soon after your father's death. And you had a discussion in the car with your mother in which she said something about somebody else who was gay, you know, asked if they were homosexual. And you used that as an opportunity to come out to her. Tell us a little bit about what happened in that car at that time.
Well, I always assumed, I mean, I had a boyfriend by that time, and he had come home, and that had gone okay, though we didn't, they just thought he was my friend, and though my father had, I think, caught on. And my mother, I think my mother was in this kind of knowing denial. And like I say, we just had a hard time talking about things like this. And so when we did, I think we both were stumbling around, and we both, you know, I think I did it in a hurtful, kind of abrupt way. And I think her reaction was kind of abrupt and unprepared for and was a little bit hurtful to me. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you go your way and I'll go mine. And I thought she was saying, well, we won't talk to each other anymore. And I think what she was saying was that you'll do your thing and I'll do mine. Well, you know, we have our different ways, but it's okay. I think that was what she was trying to say. But it's taken years for me to kind of parse that out and understand her reaction and what she was trying to say. And it was, at that moment, hurtful and scary. But I think that's a way that gay kids come out, that a lot of times the initial reaction is very, very difficult for kids. And it may be different now, but it's kind of necessary. You have to grit your teeth and get through that point. You know, it's best for people to be honest about their feelings and concerns and reservations and even disappointment. And you have to kind of lead your parents through it. It's an instant, in a way, of the child parenting the parent, mm-hmm. because you have to kind of be the grown up in a way and help them through it, and also realize that they're at that juncture, they may not be perfect, and they may say things that will hurt your feelings or that won't be perfect.
Yeah, I was really struck by how you said, you know, some things, once they're said, they're really out there. It's almost like it's a watershed. I mean, it's not that you didn't, you know, she even walked that back in the next day or so. I mean, she made very clear that she did want to have a relationship with you just by her actions and her tenderness toward you. But nonetheless, it was a shock.
I think that it's always a shock. For me, it was like, for a little bit, it was sort of like this, I think I say in the book, that it's like a door that you thought would always be open, that you never, ever considered being closed. Well, suddenly it just looked so different. It looked like an affection that was always dependable and was almost, you know, just the backbone of your life, was not going to be so stable as you thought. You notice I use the you. I guess I'm too uncomfortable with the I. But everyone has their conflicts with their parents as they grow up. And even though they are difficult, I think they are kind of necessary because you really have to, you know, differentiate yourself from your parents. So it's not just all gay and straight. It's a period where, you know, you have to establish yourself.
It's interesting also because at that moment in the car, you asked your mother if she had ever spoken with your father about it. And she, you know, she hinted that he did know.
No, she said no. She said no, we didn't. She said that she thought that, I mean, he had sort of elliptically referred to it, but that they, it was something that they couldn't talk about between them. And that was disappointing to me. That was scary to me, that they didn't even, that they weren't even able to go there. So that, you know, that told me how big it was to them, mm-hmm. that they couldn't address it because it was such a serious violation or whatever. And, but I also think it was part of that is that they were afraid that the other one would blame the other one, you know, that they, mm-hmm. that this is a sort of thing where sometimes blame is assigned or, I think that in my family, we just shy away from doing things that are very emotionally hard. But I also think that that flowed out of the fact that we never wanted to hurt each other.
Well, exactly. You know, your mother was also very secretive about her past. I mean, not that there was anything terrible about it, but she was not revealing of herself. And so what struck me so much is with the secrecy that is, you know, kind of so much at the heart of, you know, the secrecy that you talk about, you know, where people don't talk about things because they don't want to hurt each other, is so much at the center of this book. Yet you write this really honest memoir. You bare your soul to the reader. And I just wonder, how was that for you? How could you overcome the habits of a lifetime to go so deeply and reveal yourself so much to us?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it was a conscious decision exactly. I think that I was kind of alone here. I was with my mother. I guess I was sort of ready to spill. And I knew, I have always read a lot of memoir. And when I was a little kid in this small town and in high school, I read memoirs of people because it taught me how to be and how to, about other lives in the city, about, you know, about gay people, about black people, about, it took me into worlds that I couldn't go into here. And what I learned, and also from working on memoir as an editor, is that a good memoir makes you feel that the writer has become your friend or your intimate. It's about a relationship. Memoir is about a relationship. And you have to give something. You have to let them know that you trust them enough to tell them your secrets and to let down your hair. And so I guess that I needed to let down my hair and that I was doing it for an audience of sort of my perfect friends, that the person that I imagined reading this was a kind of perfect friend who would understand. And I also, when I was writing, I thought, oh, I'll go back, I'll take this out. I'll just leave this in there for now. You know, I tricked myself all the way through to be more honest. And then somehow I didn't take a lot of the stuff out that I intended to, and you know, I can't really look at the book. I don't even like to open it. I have some, and I keep them in a box in my room, and I keep the box closed. Because I don't like to think that somewhere across the, you know, road or in another town that people are reading this, because it's embarrassing to me.
That's interesting. Well, it is just a powerful and funny book. Just really loved it. It's Bettyville, a memoir by my guest, George Hodgman. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope you have good memories of your own mother.
I do.
Forever. And thank you for being so sensitive.
Thank you. George Hodgman. You can read an excerpt from Bettyville by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a new approach to taking care of our elders. Stay tuned after the break.
Trouble and care, always there, always there. Trouble and care, never far away. Trouble and care, always there, always there. Trouble and care, never far away. Life is hard, you must understand. You rise and fall just to rise again. You get knocked down, you get back up. Trouble's never far away. Trouble and care, always there, always there. Trouble and care, never far away. My grandfather worked in the mines, it made him old before his time. And when he died, he didn't have a dime. Trouble wasn't far away.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our model of caring for the elderly is broken, miserable for seniors, and unaffordable for society. But Dr. Alan Teal says he has the solution, commonsensical, cost-effective, and a lot more humane. I talked with him in 2011 about his book Alone and Invisible No More, How Grassroots Community Action and 21st Century Technologies Can Empower Our Elders to Stay in Their Homes and Lead Healthier, Happier Lives. It's called Full Circle America. Here we go with that 2011 interview where I talked with Dr. Alan Teal about it. To begin my interview with Dr. Teal, I started out by asking him to talk about the dimensions of the crisis that's facing elders now and the rest of us in the future.
The demographics are things that we've never faced before. 100 years ago, there were only 3 million Americans that were over age 65. Now there are 35 million, and within 20 years, it'll be 85 million. That's astounding in and of itself, but I think the demographics of those older individuals within the cohort are even more startling. Those over 85 years old are quintupling from 4 million to 21 million, and even the Americans over age 100 are projected by 2050 to number 1 million Americans. So this demands an entire new way of thinking, and as things now stand, most people over 85 at some point or another end up in a residential care facility. And so the economics are equally unsustainable. If you think about it and you've had the sticker shock of going out and looking at what available options cost, and if it's $5,000 a month for an assisted living facility, which in the Northeast it's approaching $6,000 or $6,500 in a lot of places, or a nursing home is approaching $10,000 a month, or if you want to stay in your own home and can find private duty care at $15 or $20 an hour, that's going to tally close to $150,000 to $200,000 a year, or $15-plus thousand a month for staying in your own home. So clearly, nobody can afford this for very long. Most people run out of their lifetime savings in 6 to 12 months. And then they're on state assistance. So no state or federal government, no private individuals, no companies can afford the current costs. So we have ridiculous costs, and just as importantly, we have a totally unacceptable quality of life. None of us would willingly trade places with most of the situations we find our elder citizens faced with.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Teal about a new approach to elder care he's pioneering. His book is Alone and Invisible No More. Thiel's work came out of his frustration with the conditions he found working with the elderly in nursing homes and assisted living. Could you describe some of those conditions that you found?
You know, they're not despicable. You know, the places are usually neat and clean. The real issue is that elders regularly complain about how long the days are, and what they yearn for are more human connections. And mostly what we've been guilty of in the healthcare field and is that we focus far too much on the medical side of the equation. A reasonable facility is one that gives you your medications on time, that responds rather promptly to a fall, that records your bowel and bladder function fine, and seeks medical attention for you when you need it. But I think most of us would readily agree that that isn't an acceptable quality of life, that we have to have way more to have a reason to get up in the morning. And those reasons that we want to get up in the morning usually have to do with human connections, connections to people, pets, sometimes family, sometimes friends, sometimes community interests. And we long for those connections that sustained us during our working years, during our raising our children, during the years when maybe when we were recently retired and we could be quite busy in the community. And all of a sudden, we're pretty isolated, and nobody really knows what happened to us, and we don't really exist in a full sense of the word. We in the healthcare field give some reasonable lip service to holistic care, but we're really not focusing on the whole individual. And I'm not trying to discount how important a role the medical field plays if you have a condition that really impairs your ability to function. But they are very much dwarfed by the need for human connections, and those things are sadly lacking most of the time in far too many good places. We just have it wrong in terms of the focus, and we all hide behind the fact that, well, there's liability and there's cost, and I think, you know, we can't get into a discussion of this without talking about liability. And I have a chapter in the book called The Dignity of Risk. It's a phrase that I borrowed from the community that works with the developmentally disabled. And in the 70s, when we were, as a society, trying to find ways to deinstitutionalize the, quote, mentally retarded at those point and get them back into community, there was a big debate about risk and how could we handle that. The dignity of risk is that we have to allow individuals the opportunity to succeed or fail. And if we don't allow them to have that option to fail, then we're depriving them of the opportunity to grow. And that really hit me real hard, because at what age are we supposed to stop growing? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we really look at our parents, our aunts and uncles, our neighbors, very much differently than we have so far. You know, and when we're looking at them with this different viewpoint, you know, it is really about what are their goals and aspirations. When was the last time many 80 and 90-year-olds were asked what do they want to do with the rest of their lives? Maybe it's something simple. You know, I just want to see my grandkids more often. I had one really curmudgeon-y older woman who the family was throwing up their hands at, and she had fired every single person that had come across her path from caregivers. And when I finally worked and worked and worked over about an hour to find out what made her tick, she finally got it and a light bulb went on, and she said, I'd really like to be down in that field behind the house and smell the spring flowers again. Mm. It really knocked me over. And I said, yeah, we can do that.
Talk about what you did do before you started this Maine approach. I mean, it sounds like you created a really wonderful number of residences, all of them mm-hmm. kind of connected mm-hmm. and focused on quality of life, not just the medical care. And yet you feel that that model has failed as well.
Sure. It should be a part of the landscape. What you're referring to are a number of assisted living homes called the Elder Care Network that a couple of colleagues and I co-founded about 15 years ago. And our goal was to try to produce home-like assisted living in small residential care facilities that would have 6 or 8 residents in them. So they would create their own kind of small nuclear living unit. And they would all be centrally administered, and that there would be an attempt to try to focus more completely on the whole person. Our goals were pretty noble, and we've done a pretty good job, but you run into interference from everywhere else. We were primarily focusing on the low-income elderly, and so that meant folks that were on state assistance, and state assistance meant that they came with all of the regulations that state assistance entails. And the assisted living world tries to address a very broad range of needs from people that are just one step shy of a nursing home to people that require just a tiny bit of extra help to live pretty independently. So it is a very broad gamut of people that make up the assisted living population, and no doubt that taxes a lot of regulatory folks and agencies to try to deal with. But within that, the medical model has created this approach to nursing home care, and it has moved that nursing home model into regulating assisted living more and more over the last 15 years.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Teel about his book, Alone and Invisible No More. It's about a new approach he's developed to elder care that helps seniors, even frail seniors, stay in their homes. That group of homes faced an $8,000 fine.
Mm-hmm.
I was, truly shocked when I read this. It seemed to be such an unreasonable situation. Maybe just in brief, sketch out what happened and what the state was demanding from you.
Well, even though most assisted living facilities, in order to try to make things more home-like and more affordable, the folks that are doing the lion's share of the staff work are folks maybe with a high school education, maybe with a little more. They have taken a personal care attendant course or a nurse's aide course. So they have a little bit of medical knowledge. They have a big heart. But then they are supposed to chart on these older individuals that are under their care, commenting on whether they have hallucinations, whether they have all of the symptoms of major depression. And the scoring system that the state uses to try to get a handle on what level of care they want to reimburse at, because everything now is graded and coded according to how much care you need, then they do 2- and 4-week look-back periods in which they pick an isolated chunk of time, and within that 7-day period of time, for instance, they want to find 2 or 3 notations that that individual was hallucinating, and they want it in the notes. And if it doesn't exist in the notes, it doesn't exist. And so because the individuals that we were taking care of and for whom we were fined, they could find 2 notations in 7 days when they wanted 3, or they could find 3 notations in 28 days when they wanted 4. That was considered a chart that was in error, and that the coding for that was insufficient to support the diagnosis of that mental health condition. And they reviewed 6 individuals' charts, decided that 3 of them, in the 400 different questions that they asked, had an error somewhere in those 400 questions. And based on 1 error in 400 questions on that individual, the whole chart was considered to have been wrongly coded. And 3 errors in 3 charts gave you a 60% error rate and set you up for this fine of $8,000 to $10,000 for that whole period, because they now take that as representative of the care administered in that home, and they fine you 10% of the entire state payment to that home over the previous 3 to 6 months.
And it was like almost that you were on trial.
Absolutely. When I challenged it as the chairman of the board and said, somebody's got to speak up on this. And after 2 years later, we finally got to have an administrative hearing. And when we sat down for the administrative hearing, the hearing officer introduced me to the rules of the proceedings, that both sides, my side and the state, would be able to call witnesses, that we would be able to cross-examine each other's witnesses, that there would be opening and closing arguments. And I looked across the table, and the person who was representing the state was the Assistant Attorney General. And so here we were, a small residential care assisted living home, and we were literally on trial for defending our actions around these frail 90-year-old individuals. We were not trying to say that the documentation was better than it was. We were saying the rules themselves don't make any sense, and the severity of the penalty doesn't make any sense. To threaten the financial survival of a home that had been applauded by many other state agencies over these picayune details wasn't logical.
Yeah. And is that typical, would you say?
It is absolutely typical. It's the way every single home is graded. And actually, as states get into more difficult budget crises, they are looking for ways to recoup their costs. Mm-hmm. They are seeing this is a way to balance their budgets better by getting some of the money back. So this is going to become more and more of an issue as more and more state governments are faced with the difficulties of trying to pay for residential care.
You know, I know your book isn't, you know, came up before this happened, but I just have to ask you, we are hearing now that Obama and the Republicans are kind of getting together on slashing Social Security and Medicare. What kind of effect do you think that that might have on nursing homes like the ones that you helped to start? Assisted living homes. Right.
Well, clearly the money that is spent in the residential care world is a large piece of the Medicare budget. You know, there are states where something like 50% of the Medicaid dollars that are allocated to that state are spent for residential care. There are numbers that say that the nursing home industry right now is a $100 billion a year industry. Now, we're talking about very large numbers. If we continue to do what we're doing in terms of the utilization rate of residential care facilities for older individuals, over the next 20 years, most small communities of 50,000 people will need to build 3 more nursing homes and 8 or 10 more assisted living facilities in their communities. The cost of building these in each of these small communities is going to approach $100 million to build these facilities and then $50 million a year to run them. That translates to $5,000 worth of new cost for every single household in every single community.
Wow.
$5,000 a year.
For every one of us.
For every household in every community for business as usual.
And so you have this model that you've developed, the main approach that you say can provide better care at a lesser cost. Tell us what that is.
Well, what we're trying to do is employ a new attitude, as I've talked to you about, you know, where we focus on what are the goals and aspirations, but we're also trying to tap into this enormous talent pool of elders. And that is to say, no matter what your age, what do you still have left in the tank? What is it that you can still do that is of value to somebody else around you? And how do we parcel out the jobs that need doing, the tasks that need doing, to the entire cohort of people in our community, the entire elders and the rest of the age groups in our community? If most of what we're lacking is connections to people, and most older individuals are feeling lonely and isolated, well, how do we get people together more? For instance, we had an older individual who lived in one of our assisted living facilities with mild dementia, who was a childhood friend of a lady whose family was providing around-the-clock care for her for her moderate dementia in her own home. We had the very simple idea of putting them together a couple of afternoons a week under the care of the woman with mild dementia in the residential care facility. They watched each other and laughed and joked like schoolgirls. They needed no supervision for those two afternoons. They handled everything perfectly fine within a minimally supervised setting. So the goal was, no matter how frail somebody might be physically or mentally, what are the things they can do? If you told me, you know, several years ago that you could take folks with significant mental and physical impairments and move them on the spur of the moment into somebody else's space and get away with it, my medical side would have said, no, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it really worked surprisingly well. So we've tried to replicate that.
Let me ask you a question, because I read all this in your book, Dr. Alan Teal, and the book is Alone and Invisible No More, How Grassroots Community Action and 21st Century Technologies Can Empower Elders to Stay in Their Homes and Lead Healthier, Happier Lives. I read it very much with my mom in mind. You know, we're thinking of bringing her back home. But the question that I had is, you know, she's lively of mind, but she has become quite immobile.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid to have her live alone, even with motion sensors.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about how you use the technology, and could she really live alone?
Well, it gets back to what is a reasonable amount of risk to take for what kind of quality of life. You know, and I'm not saying that you move her into an apartment and then, you know, nobody checks in on her. What we're really trying to do is individualize every single situation as much as possible. And that being said, I admit an awful lot more patients to the hospital with broken hips and broken bones that they've suffered at the residential care facilities than I have in their own homes.
Wow.
People fall down. You know, and sometimes you get hurt and sometimes you don't. And that being said, it requires a great deal of attention to detail to try to figure out what kind of risk the individual really has. Many folks, if you watch them on these webcams that we're using, they do furniture walk. They do move cautiously. And fortunately, most of these individuals, they've gotten used to navigating in their own space quite safely.
Right.
And actually, they get into more trouble when you move them to an unfamiliar space than if you try to provide some assistance for them in their own space. But let's take worst-case scenario. How do you handle somebody within their own space? And we have physical therapists that also watch somebody walk and say, oh, my goodness, how could you possibly let this person? They might fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they have made us all really frightened of our own shadows at times. I look at my dad walking, and he throws his hips from one side to the other and looks very awkward in his gait. But he hasn't fallen down in his house ever. So what we've done is try to learn what the trouble spots are in folks' lives by the motion sensors and the webcams and our direct observation. But we're starting from a different vantage point, and that is, as I mentioned earlier, what are your goals and aspirations? And if that individual says, I wouldn't want to live if you moved me to a residential care facility, you would extinguish all desire of mine to live at all if you did that. Well, then we better start from that starting point and try to figure out a way to make something work. And if we do, what does that model look like? Well, we put webcams in the common spaces, and if somebody is really frail, we even put webcams in a bedroom. But we tend to angle it to the places where they're going to fall, the space between the bed and the bathroom,
right,
not necessarily on the bed. And yet, with strategically placed webcams that are motion-driven so that they take snapshots, we can then spot check these. We can actually watch live video. These spot checks are available to family members as well as anyone else that individual gives us permission to share it with. So Usually it's doctors and nurses and family.
And how much does something like this cost? I mean, you're talking about maybe somebody having personal care coming in, you know, a couple of hours a day. You're saying that this is less costly.
Sure. Well, we're able to do all of the technology and the monitoring and all of the coordination of volunteers, the coordination of family members, the coordination of caregivers, and we've been able to do that whole tech, provide all of the technology, maintain the technology, install the technology, and pay attention to all of the remote monitoring with it for about $400 a month. And so if you take $400 a month and add to it whatever personal care somebody needs, we've been able to find that even folks that were qualified by the conventional scoring as needing nursing home level of care, they can survive quite nicely in their home, much happier, with 1 or 2 hours a day of personal care and 22 or 23 hours a day of remote monitoring. And that you got to break up that time. So if you are paying for an hour of care, a lot of folks need a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour at night.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the nursing homes and other services, for their own financial constraints, make you have 2 or 3 hour minimums.
Right.
And so we're trying to break that mold, and we're trying to say, what is it you really need? And some of it you need a paid staff person for, and sometimes you just need a volunteer or neighbor to spot check you. The person who brings the newspaper to your door, they can really tell somebody whether you're on the floor or not.
Right.
There are a lot of things you don't need a trained medical person to do. A lot of times you need somebody to heat up a microwave meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that isn't something you need a medical degree for. You know, there are a whole lot of those personal touches that if we can combine those with an hour or so of paid staff care, you know, look at it the other way around. If you had to pay for 24-hour care and you can cut that down to 12 hours a day, you've reduced the cost by half.
Right.
If you can break it down to 6 hours a day, you've reduced it by three quarters. If you can get it down to an hour or two a day, you've reduced the cost by 90-95% for the labor charges. You know, so we're not able to find people that will work for less, and as a matter of fact, we're not trying to. We're actually trying to say that the folks that do this noble work should be paid reasonably well. So we're trying to get away from also the current paradigm where many of these individuals that do the lion's share of the heavy lifting literally are paid minimum wage or only a little bit more than that. And we feel that they should be reasonably paid.
But yet not needed as much.
And we can actually stretch out the kind of care that these folks can do so that we get more good people doing more work for more people, and the cost per person is an awful lot less.
That was Dr. Alan Teal talking with Writer's Voice in 2011. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.